Hello and welcome to Our Science, the podcast bringing you updates from across the Royal Society. I'm Marie-Claude Dupuis.
And I'm Ben Cunningham.
This month, we're bringing you a series of interviews about climate change. First, the Royal Society and US National Academy of Sciences have released a joint publication outlining the evidence and causes of climate change. It aims to provide an accessible overview of climate change science. We spoke to Professor Eric Wolfe, the UK lead scientist on the project, to find out more.
I'm here with Professor Eric Wolfe, who's part of a Royal Society and US National Academy of Science collaborative group who've produced a new overview on the science of climate change. Welcome, Professor Wolfe. So I wonder if you could just start giving a bit of an overview about the project and the document that you've produced.
Thank you. So the idea was that we got together experts in climate from both the Royal Society and the US National Academy of Science and have looked at all the evidence about recent climate change and its causes and tried to explain it in an accessible way. So this obviously follows on from the recent report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but our report has the additional facet that it's got the authority of the top experts in our two academies. So what we have done is to say what has happened, why it's happened as to our best knowledge, and what we think will happen in the future. And the idea then is that this forms a solid basis on which governments and society can make decisions about whether they want to do anything about it or what they want to do. But at least they don't have to argue about the science because we're trying to explain clearly what the scientific outcome is.
So what are the key points that are mentioned in the report?
Well, firstly, we explain the basis on which we expect that climate change will occur as a result of increasing concentrations of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide. And this is very well understood science, very well understood physics, essentially. We point out that we really do know that carbon dioxide has increased due to human activities and that the climate has been changing over the last few decades with a warming of about 0.8 degrees over the last century. And associated with that, things like rising sea level and reducing Arctic sea ice. And then we talk about what this means for what we think will happen in the future, which undoubtedly has lots of uncertainties. The biggest uncertainty, of course, is how much carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, but there are also uncertainties about how much warming this will cause. But at the present state of knowledge, this is an uncertainty that we have to live with, and that is society, is going to have to make decisions knowing that something will happen, but being uncertain as to exactly what will happen. And as long as we understand that basis, then we can move forward and start making policy decisions about what to do.
So how is the evidence presented in the report? How accessible is it to readers?
Well, we hope that the evidence is very accessible. It's presented in essentially two different ways. Firstly, we've got what we call a climate basics, which is really things that are very well understood, the basis on which we believe that climate change occurs. And then there's a series of 20 questions and answers. So they're the questions that we hear from the public and from governments that they really want to know about, both about what will happen and also about why we're not sure sometimes what will happen. And each of those we answer based on the latest evidence in a way that we think is accessible. And I suppose the primary point is that the report will be available in print and online. And so you will be able to dip into it, and maybe you only want to know about a couple of questions, you don't want to read the whole thing. Or alternatively, if you read the whole thing, you'll get a pretty good primer of what we know about climate science at the moment.
The document is now available on our website, where you can also submit your own questions about climate change to be answered by Professor Wolfe or one of his fellow climate scientists who produced the document. Next up, Yuba Sokona from the South Centre in Geneva, and also a member of the Royal Society's Resilience Project Working Group, introduces the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC.
UNFCCC is the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, and that deal with the negotiations on climate change since the adoption of the convention back to the early 90s after the Rio conference. Every year it held a conference of the parties, and along with the conference of the parties at the of the Kyoto Protocol, since the protocol has been adopted. It's an yearly event, and then to discuss all aspects related to the implementation of the convention and then as well as on the protocol.
And what about Yuba's own experience of attending the most recent UNFCCC Conference of the Parties, which took place in Warsaw at the end of last year? Here, he explains why he was there and how this conference ties in with the other major international climate change body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, and its three working groups. Over the course of this year, the IPCC will be releasing the most up-to-date scientific information on climate science, mitigation and adaptation in the form of the eagerly awaited fifth assessment report.
I was there for a number of reasons as a member of the, as one of the co-chairs of IPCC, and then to get a sense of what the negotiators and what the various stakeholders in the climate are interested in, and what are the topical issues, what are the interests, and at the same time, supporting my colleagues of the Working Group 1 who just completed their contribution to the fifth assessment report of IPCC, the Working Group 1. And then they made a presentation to the plenary, and then they organized a number of side events. And we also, different members of the IPCC working groups 1, 2, and 3, we had some dialogue with a number of stakeholders, including the private sector, and then to give, to respond to some of the questions they have, and then to give the indication on the progress we have made so far in the completion of the report. Because the Working Group 2 and Working Group 3 report is due next April. For the Working Group 2, it will be in Yokohama, and Working Group 3, it will be in Berlin.
Moving closer to home, climate change is also high on the UK's political agenda, thanks to the devastating floods that have wreaked havoc across much of southern England. But can these floods, or other extreme weather events for that matter, be attributed to climate change? Mark Pelling, Professor of Geography at King's College London, who spoke at a Royal Society Policy Lab event on science and disasters, explains why that question is very difficult to answer.
The question of attribution of disaster events and climate change is really critical. It's also unanswerable at the moment for a statistical reason. The amount of time series required to be able to attribute discrete disaster events to climate change, given that the length of time between different disaster events is often quite long, they are extremes after all, so unusual, is unavailable in the record. So we would need 30, 40 years of climate change in being observed to then see the extent to which disaster events are more frequent in that period than before the observed period of climate change. And we don't have that. We may have 5 or 6 years of observed climate change, perhaps. I mean, there are different arguments. So statistically, it's rather difficult to make a claim for attribution. The other argument is based on observation and experience, and that seems to present quite a strong case for the association, if not the attribution, of climate change to extreme weather events. Underlying all of that is certainly the realization that rapid social change is increasing exposure regardless of climate change. So to some extent, the question of attribution, whilst being critical to the climate change debate, is less critical for acting on reducing vulnerability and risk. The vulnerability is driven by development process rather than climate change or environmental change of any kind. So we need to understand attribution, but it shouldn't stop us from acting.
What are our options, and how do we decide which is the best approach to take? These are just some of the questions being addressed by the Royal Society's policy project on human resilience to climate change and extreme weather. We spoke to the chair of the project, Professor Georgina Mace, to find out more.
I'm here with Professor Georgina Mace, who is chair of the Royal Society policy project looking at human resilience to climate change and weather-related disasters. Welcome, Georgina, to the R Science podcast. I wonder if you could just give us a bit of an overview about what the project is about.
Well, this is one of the Royal Society's science policy projects. So we're trying to corral some of the relevant science to help policymakers make decisions about how to manage some of the risks that are going to come from climate change related weather events. So we're thinking particularly about things like increased risks of flooding from storms, either inland or in coastal areas. We're thinking about heat waves, bushfires, and of course just the general change in extreme weather that may affect many people and their livelihoods. The way in which we're approaching this is to also try to bring together that longer term view about climate change related hazards with the existing work that's being done on disaster risk reduction, because in fact these two things come together in the future. So how do you deal with disasters now so that they better reduce risks for people from extreme events in the future?
So what is the main thing that you want this project to achieve?
This area of resilience to climate change related hazards is actually a very complicated one. It cuts across environmental management, it cuts into people's livelihoods. There are big issues for governments with respect to environmental and urban planning, and there's big issues for business and industry, particularly the insurance industry. And it has been an area of work that's evolved from many different strands coming together. So one thing that we're hoping to do is just to provide some more coherent framework for thinking about the whole issue, making it clear where those connections should come. Where does the science contribute? Where does the policy making need to draw on different areas of knowledge and decision making? So we're hoping to primarily provide knowledge to the international community. There's a range of international agencies, conventions that try to deal with this area, but also to be useful to government, business and industry in their decision making.
So what stage is the project at the moment?
Well, like all these sorts of projects, we've spent a fair amount of time preparing for the project. So over the past year, we've spent a lot of time developing the ideas and testing them on various potential user groups. So over last summer, we did a brief consultation with some of our original ideas. And then in the autumn, we launched a call for evidence, asking various sectors for information to contribute to the report. And through that period of 6 or 9 months since last summer, the project has changed its focus a bit, but we're now fairly clear what the focus is. We've formed a working group that has experts from a whole range of related areas, everything from climate science, flood protection, through to representatives from government, industry and the international conventions. And just before Christmas, we had a group that framed the report and set in train a whole series of activities to gather more evidence. So at the moment, we're pursuing these more detailed lines of investigation. In the late spring, summer of this year, we'll draw all those together and provide some general conclusions and recommendations, which again we'll test on the user community before we get the report reviewed for its scientific and technical accuracy through the Royal Society's networks.
Many scientists are working to help develop technologies that will make our lives greener. Professor Saiful Islam is one such scientist. He's a computational chemist who is working to develop safe and efficient lithium batteries for use in electric cars. He came to the Royal Society to present at a Café Scientifique event. We caught him just before he gave his talk to ask him about his research.
So I'm here with Professor Saiful Islam, a Royal Society Wolfson Research Merit Award holder at the University of Bath, who is running a Café Scientifique event tonight entitled Can Crystals Help Produce Cleaner Energy? So, Professor Islam, welcome to the podcast. Perhaps you could start by explaining a bit about your research at Bath.
My research really revolves around looking at new crystalline materials for clean energy applications. And they can be lithium-ion batteries for electric cars, or fuel cells, which could be used as combined heat and power within homes. I'm one of those chemists that doesn't wear a white lab coat. I use computer modelling techniques to try and understand these crystalline materials on the atomic level and try and develop new and better ones.
So how would these new batteries differ from batteries already available?
Well, the current lithium-ion batteries, which have helped to revolutionise portable electronics, they're really ubiquitous now, from your mobile phone to your laptop to your tablet, and all around us. They use mainly cobalt oxides within them, a small amount. But the problem with cobalt is that they're costly and toxic, and some of the batteries are intrinsically unsafe, although they are well managed. So we're trying to develop new materials that could be used within electric and hybrid electric cars. So you have to move away from cobalt, and they could be either iron-based, manganese-based. In fact, some of the materials we looked at are made of iron and silicon, so they've got the tantalising prospect of making battery materials from rust and sand.
So I hear you'll be using 3D glasses for your talk later. What will you be using them to demonstrate?
Well, I mentioned I used computer modelling techniques to look at these crystalline materials. What computer modelling allows us to do is look at these beautiful structures on the atomic level. And what I'm hoping to show with these 3D images, and I've brought along 3D specs as well, is that these crystalline materials are intricate and complex on the atomic level, but also aesthetically very beautiful. So it's really showing that science, good science, can not only have the wonder and beauty of equivalent to the arts.
So why science?
That's a very broad question. Well, first say how I got into science, briefly. I didn't have an inspirational chemistry teacher. I didn't have a chemistry set, but I really enjoyed chemistry and science at A-level and went to do chemistry at University College London as a degree. But I got really passionate about chemistry at science during my PhD when I worked on high-temperature superconductors, which were being developed, and that was a very exciting time. I'm still passionate about science because I think science is very important. If you think about any major challenge or problem that's facing humanity in the 21st century, whether it's energy, water, food, disease, and I suppose even poverty, science can make a crucial role in trying to find solutions for those major challenges. And I think I'm really, really excited to be involved in that scientific endeavour.
Well, that's it for this episode, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit royalsociety.org for more information on what is happening at the Royal Society, or to follow us on Twitter and Facebook.